start whenever you're ready.
Great. Thank you, Your Honor. Now, Jonathan Robinson was initially charged in the General District Court in Amelia with sexual battery under 18.2-67.4, subparagraph A1. Before trial in the General District, the Commonwealth amended to subparagraph A2, and then at the end of the trial in the General District, the court found that they couldn't convict under A2, but amended back to convict him under A1 as a lesser included. We appealed that, and in the circuit court, we were going forward under subparagraph 1, which is sexual battery, which is accomplished through threat, force, intimidation, or ruse. At the close of the Commonwealth's case, we moved to strike. The court struck as to ruse, but not as to force, threat, or intimidation. At the conclusion of trial, the judge convicted specifically based on force, and specifically stated that the force requirements met, and I'll quote the court's ruling here, because of the manner in which she said that he grabbed and held and twisted her breasts. So the issue here on appeal then is, in the act of grabbing and twisting her, did he exert the force necessary? This court in Johnson versus Commonwealth held that the force must be sufficient to overcome the will of the complaining witness, and that the force must be more than the force merely employed to accomplish the unlawful touching.
Well, can I ask you on that?
Yes.
Hate to interrupt you, but your time goes by really fast here, as you know. For the sexual battery, if he had simply touched her breast, I could understand your argument better than it says here. He grabbed her breast right behind her nipples and twisted as hard as he could. Why wouldn't that be enough force to overcome her will? Or
if the grabbing, holding, and twisting altogether is the touching, is the act, the squeezing and twisting, the holding and twisting, does not do anything to further overcome her will. It doesn't restrain her. It doesn't restrict her movement. There's no evidence that he did anything to restrict her movement in any way or to
presumably it was
force him.
Painful and uncomfortable for her to try to get away from him like that. She said she had to eventually. She slapped his hand away,
but she also said that he let go right away. So the moment she slapped his hand, expressed to unhand me essentially by physically slapping him, he let go right away.
But her sister testified that it went on for about a minute or so, right?
She did. However, I would argue that the trial court specifically said because of the manner in which she said that he grabbed, held, and twisted. So I believe that from that language, the trial court is relying on the complaining witness's testimony, not the conflicting testimony of her sister. Pardon me. So the question, though, is in doing that, did he exert force to overcome her will, or was the grabbing, holding, and twisting merely the act itself? And to address part you said, you mentioned doing that would be painful. Well, sexual battery is just another version of battery. Punching someone would also be painful, but it doesn't change the nature of the touching. You can commit battery by simply touching someone when they don't want you to, or by punching them. That may affect the degree of how a trial court punishes you for it, but it doesn't change the category.
So your contention is that it has to be accomplished by force, not that there is force involved in the actual battery, but that it is taking place by force.
Yes, and that's exactly what this court held in Johnson versus Commonwealth, is that the force has to be more than merely the force necessary to accomplish the act, and that it has to be force sufficient to overcome the defendant's will. Now, the Commonwealth, in its brief, is asking the court to look at additional circumstances and evidence of the record, interactions, statements, things that happened either before or after, but the court should not do that. The Commonwealth is relying on Dew versus Commonwealth and Pedroia versus Commonwealth, effectively asking the court to apply the right result for the wrong reason doctrine in this case, and look at a lot of other circumstances and factors.
But case law indicates that if we have enough facts on the record that we can do that, so why would the Commonwealth's position be incorrect?
Well, Dew versus Commonwealth cites to Perry versus Commonwealth. And Perry, quoting Whitehead versus Commonwealth, says that the proper application of this rule does not include those cases where, because a trial court has rejected the right reason or confined its decision to a specific ground, further factual resolution is needed before the right reason may be assigned to support the trial court's decision. And here we have the judge specifically and expressly narrowing his finding to, because of her testimony that he grabbed, held, and twisted, the force was there. by specifically narrowing his ruling to that act, he's effectively rejecting other evidence or other theories of the force being met. And because the court doesn't make any other finding of facts, this court there should not substitute its judgment for the fact finder's judgment. He may not have relied on the other facts because he didn't see that evidence as credible. He may not have relied on that other evidence because he didn't see it as sufficient for a conviction on sexual battery. But the record is quiet as to that. So as to what the fact finder actually held was reliable or wasn't, there's really nothing on the record that says that. There's lots of evidence on the record, but the court only specifically found one thing sufficient and didn't address the conflicting testimony or anything else. So the court shouldn't look at a lot of other things that happened before or after, the things that were said. The court should focus on the simple question, when he grabbed her and held and twisted her, did that exert the force necessary to overcome her will? And our argument, of course, is that it did not. It was merely the force necessary to accomplish the act.
And you're saying that the trial court specifically found it only on force, not on intimidation or
Absolutely.
Any of the other factors.
Absolutely. And in the trial court, I'll say, could have been more express by saying not threat or intimidation, but it specifically said, I believe that the force element is met because of this. And so its finding was limited to force. In doing so, the court, as I stated in the brief, the trial court mistook the act for the force. And we should here narrow the consideration to whether the trial court got the right result for the right reason, rather than looking at the right result for the wrong reason. pardon me.
So we can't consider, I gather from something you just said, that once she smacked his hand away and basically told him to leave her alone, he then smacked her pretty hard on her buttocks.
I don't think the record says that he smacked her hard, but I could be wrong, but it does say he smacked her.
Well, smack seems to be that, if you look up the word smack, it doesn't usually imply that it's just a touch.
Certainly. Which, again, could itself be battery. But the question is, was it sexual battery? Was doing it forcefully forced to overcome the will, or just doing the battery vigorously, for lack of a better word? I think that's the question. But I also think that because the trial court did not say, because of the way he grabbed, held, and twisted her, and then smacked her butt, and then I believe grabbed her in the front, I believe the force element is met. It didn't rely on a combination of those things. It was a one specific act. The grabbing, holding, and twisting of her breast was sufficient, but it was the force for the sexual battery. And so I think that's why this case is so common, is so similar to the Woodard case. The Commonwealth correctly points out that in Woodard, the issue was intimidation, not force. However, the facts line up very similarly. The Commonwealth was trying to argue intimidation based on the defendant's behavior before the act in question, but the court said that effectively the unlawful touching or unwanted touching was accomplished by surprise, not by intimidation. In Woodard, they were standing in the victim's doorway, and he abruptly grabbed her a couple of times and then left. Here, Robinson opens the door for her, abruptly grabs her. When smacked away, he lets go. And so, although there was, the evidence shows there was touching, and the court found there was touching that was unwanted, there's no force beyond the touching itself. Excuse me. In fact, the fact that he let go when she smacked her hand away, she doesn't testify that she had to push back or shove or anything. She had to smack him vigorously or a couple of times. So she smacked his hand away, immediately let go. That actually shows that he was not attempting to employ force.
But her response is not necessarily commensurate with the force that he might be using, is it?
I'm sorry, I didn't follow.
Just because she's engaging in some sort of forceful way of getting him off, mm-hmm. or isn't, doesn't mean that he's not doing something forceful to accomplish the touching.
Correct. I guess my point is that there's no evidence that, for example, he held her against the wall or held her in place or forced her to stay where she was. The evidence that he grabbed, held, and twisted and then let go.
Right, but you were arguing or suggesting that because her response wasn't forceful, then it was an indication that there was no force on his part.
I see. Not so much that because it wasn't forceful, although I think that is an indication. If her response is more forceful, then and there's resistance, certainly he's using force to overcome her will. I still mean that the absence of a forceful attempt to get away or something more, something showing that he was restraining her, wouldn't let her leave or get away, something of that nature, that would be more indicative of the use of force. We don't have that here. We have really compliance. Once she smacked his hand, he let go immediately, which is, I don't think she used the word immediately in her testimony, but that's the way I read it, at least. And the way I saw it at trial is that she smacked her hand, he let go right away. And that the act of letting go right away really shows almost compliance, not unwanted touching, but then compliance when she smacked his hand away. And I think it's the fact that he did so without any more from her shows that he wasn't using force to overcome her will, because if she smacked his hand away and he persisted, I think that would be a different scenario. And so, for those reasons, I think that the trial court mistook the act for the force. I think here there was no force used except the force necessary to accomplish the act, and the court should overturn the trial court's ruling. If there are any other questions, otherwise I'll get out.
Good afternoon. Donald Jeffrey, appearing on behalf of the Commonwealth. I would certainly take issue with several of the arguments that were made this morning. The suggestion that the Commonwealth is relying on right result, wrong reason is not correct. The argument that the defendant is making here, in fact, flies in the face of the Supreme Court of Virginia's holding in Bolden and the later case of Due, which was actually cited in our brief, which says that on appellate review of sufficiency, this court is not limited to things that were either argued by the Commonwealth in this case or statements that the trial judge made. So this suggestion that you can't rely on anything except the victim's testimony is just incorrect as a matter of law. And the most significant point to that is the testimony from Miss Owenby, the victim's sister, about how this act went on for a minute after the victim asked for the defendant to cease and desist. That is part of the calculus here.
Mr. Jeffries, is it significant, though, that we don't know what is occurring during that minute? We have a time frame. We have the fact that there's the grabbing and the twisting, but we don't know what else is occurring.
Under the facts of this case, I don't think it is significant because, again, remembering that you're under a totality analysis, I would submit to the court that viewed in the light most favorable to the Commonwealth, and again, I cited a case on brief about this standard applies to inferences too. When you say that somebody's twisted any body part as hard as that person can, that connotes that the person felt pain, which is certainly more than is necessary to inflict the act. But
well, I think counsel's position is that the actual touching, grabbing, twisting is the act. So if that is the act, where is the force necessary to accomplish it? If we're accepting his premise that that is the act.
Except that it's more than is necessary to commit a simple battery. There's a degree of force that's beyond what would necessarily be needed to grab someone's breast. I guess I take issue with the proposition. I think you could commit the sexual battery without twisting and inflicting pain. I think that's the additional. Just like, and I know Judge Beals, there was additional evidence in this case. It was an opinion that you wrote, the Konczewski case, if I'm pronouncing the defendant's name right, where this court held it was part of the calculus that the fact that the person was grabbed in the course of the sexual assault was additional force. Now, I mean, I have to be upfront, as I was on brief, that there was there was penetration in that case, and the victim also testified that she had asked the defendant to stop. But the court did find it significant that you had the grabbing as being things that was force used to accomplish the act.
But isn't that two separate acts, the grabbing and then the penetration? I guess what I'm asking and I'm trying to distinguish from what he's putting forth is that essentially the grabbing and twisting is one act, as opposed to what you typically have in sort of a rape scenario where there is that distinct grab or hold or whatever before there's the penetration.
I would submit to you when you consider the total package that it's really, I think, kind of the same argument that was made below, that is more than is necessary to accomplish that type of battery. He inflicted pain. He was asked to cease and desist, and he continued to hold on for another minute after that. I think that's just more than is necessary. Because I think, to be perfectly frank, I think merely grabbing without Abruptly was one of the words used in one of the other cases that was cited on brief. This is more than an abrupt grabbing. There's a twisting and there's a continuity here, which I think, viewed in the light most favorable to Commonwealth, is that is more than is necessary to accomplish this act under the statute. Those are the additional facts, and it is significant. I certainly cited on brief Clark, I think, is the name of the case that I'm looking for. Clark is the case where there was all the force that was necessary was the defendant being on top of the victim in that case.
But in that Clark case, there were repeated incidents of the sexual abuse, and the court relied pretty significantly on the fact that it was not just force but intimidation, because it was her natural father.
Right, there were certainly some other elements there.
Yes, so you're saying you could have sexual battery they talk a lot about intimidation here. Here there's no intimidation. The question is whether the force is more than that necessary to accomplish the act.
Right.
No question that the act is against her will, that's non-consensual. But she's not restrained in any way other than you're saying it's the length of time of the action and relying on the sister's testimony that went on for a minute.
Correct. And I think that is adequate. It is more than is necessary to accomplish the act. And I'll admit to you, obviously these cases are very fact-specific. I didn't want to oversell Konczewski, and I'll never pronounce that word in a million years.
We won't tell anybody, Mr. Close enough.
I think you've made a valiant effort.
The court certainly makes those discrete points in those cases. I understand your point, Judge O'Brien, about the intimidation being an aspect, but the court certainly talked about the force element being covered by the lying on top there, just as in Konczewski, the court focused on the grabbing. And I'm sure, Judge Beals, I'm sure you remember that opinion. There was a concurrence in that case that said that grabbing wasn't enough, and then went into constructive force and that was adequate. That was then Judge Powell's concurrence. But here you've got somebody inflicting pain, being asked to stop, and that's just more than is necessary to grab someone's breast. When I think of a more than the force necessary, I thought that there was a case where somebody got grabbed in a library, and it was sort of very quick grabbing, and then the person fled, and I never could find that. Well, maybe I read it from out of state, but
there's an unpublished case from Judge Willis in 1997, the Wilson case, where the defendant hit the victim with such force on her buttocks that caused her to lose her balance and stumble forward, and said he just couldn't resist, or he grabbed her buttocks, whatever. He just couldn't resist. And we said basically that was very ungentlemanly, and it was
right.
A battery, but it was, despite the fact that it was private parts, touching of private parts, it was not accomplished by any more force than necessary to do the act. You're right, they're fact-specific.
Other than stating the obvious, which is that it's unpublished,
said,
and you're not bound by it.
Right.
I would suggest here that if I were to assume that case were binding on you, I would suggest that the sister's testimony here kind of takes you beyond that. Don't do that. Let me put some more facts in that case. Don't do that again, and then he smacks her again. I think the court would probably say you're getting real close to force if you're not over the line at that point. And that's a fact I think that you have in this case.
So your argument is the force could well be holding her like that for a long period of time. That's the force when she's clearly uncomfortable and wants to be away from him.
Being sensitive to Judge O'Brien's comments about the other things that were in Clark, and being sensitive to the fact that I understand that when you wrote that opinion in Konczewski, there were other facts besides the grabbing, but I think that would be my position. A significant amount of time of grabbing her arm, dragging her anywhere, something like that, I think arguably it would be. Is the victim's testimony enough on its own? Obviously, that's not a question you have to decide, because we've got that additional minute here, roughly. That was an estimate, obviously, by the testimony from the victim's sister. But I think that's my long-winded way of saying yes to your question, Judge Fields. I did want to be careful with cases like Clark and Konczewski. But I read those, to be perfectly honest, I read those as discrete parts of those opinions. I think that's important here. I think you've got those two facts here. You know, I certainly didn't mean to suggest that I did cite some of the other factors. I don't think any of those other factors on their own would carry the day in this case, but they're certainly part of the puzzle. I don't know if it's fair to say this. You know, my reading of this record, although to be perfectly frank, it's an inference that I drew that may not be a fair one, that this victim and her husband were living with this person because they had financial problems, maybe. And this record is certainly replete with him, with the defendant saying, I'm going to take advantage of the situation. Again, on their own, do those facts mean anything? Probably not, because I think defense counsel is absolutely right that this case largely ends up rising and falling on the force surrounding the act. But I don't think you can ignore that as part of the entire patchwork quilt of what's going on here. And I do think those facts are fair as part of the sufficiency analysis, again, even if they wouldn't carry the day for the Commonwealth on their own. I think you asked a question a while ago, Judge Malvo, that I probably answered at this point.
I think you're close enough.
Close enough, okay. Some days that's as good as it gets. Yeah, I do think that there were some important points that were made here as far as legal issues in this case. First of all, aside from the fact that I indicated to you that I think Bolden kind of governs what was said about the trial judge's comment, I would only note that this is on page 58 of the Joint Appendix, starting at line 3. I don't think that read in light most favorable to the Commonwealth, he even says what the defense is suggesting. Based on the fact that I believe Ms. Webb's testimony and believe that the evidence indicates that the requisite degree of force was applied, I think the evidence is sufficient and will find Mr. Robinson guilty. That to me is sort of a textbook example of the application of Bolden. He does not say, I discredit the other testimony. He in fact says, just in a very general sense, believe that the evidence and believe that the evidence indicates that the requisite degree of force was applied. I think that means it's a classic application of Bolden. You look at the sister's testimony too. I did want to make that point because this notion that we're limited to what the victim said is just incorrect, first of all. And you know, I'll go back because I only hit this in a footnote in my brief. Obviously, I cited Clifford. Even if the victim's testimony conflicted on that 1 minute point, which I don't believe that it does, she never said that. She described a sequence. I don't believe she was ever asked about any sort of duration. So to suggest that the testimony is conflicting is just incorrect. But under Clifford, I believe Clifford cited Massey v. Firmstone, which goes back 1,000 years, I think, to the Supreme Court of Virginia. We can ask you to credit the sister's testimony. So even if the premise were correct, and I submit to you that it's not, we get the benefit of the sister's testimony on that point. And based on some of the questions that I've gotten this morning, that might actually be a significant issue in this case. But I don't think, you know, the testimony, I believe, starts on the victim's testimony, I think, on that particular incident starts on page 19. And she was never asked about that, to my best reading of the record. So I think to say it's conflicting is just incorrect as a matter of fact.
The sister, I believe, on 24 said that the appellant eventually stopped touching her sister after she asked him to stop, but only about a minute later.
Correct. And I think under the appropriate standard of review, that is a fact that is before this court at this point. You know, I did want to make the Bolden point because, not to beat a dead horse, but we absolutely get that testimony here. Now, I would submit to you as appellee coming forward in this court, the only way we don't get that is I found the sister to be a bald-faced liar, and I don't believe a thing that came out of her mouth. And some express finding by the trial court. This used to be, you know, we used to have more problems with this, I think, prior to Bolden, because occasionally a trial judge will focus on, I found Officer Jones's testimony to be particularly credible. Well, that doesn't mean we don't get Officer Smith and Officer Jackson and the victim, and all that stuff comes into the mix. Again, absent express discrediting of that witness's testimony, that is part of the mix here on appeal, as the court knows full well. And in part because of the argument, I did want to sort of drive that home a little bit this morning. As far as the case law, I think I covered pretty much everything I wanted to about the cases on brief. And unless the court has further questions, I would simply ask that you affirm the judgment below.
Thank you. Mr. Hannigan?
So I think it is important to note that there is conflict in the testimony between the two witnesses. The victim, Ms. Webb, does not specifically state a time frame. I think he's right. I don't believe she was asked for one. However, when asked what she did, she said, "I smacked his hand away and he let go." The sister testified that she said to let go and that he did. It doesn't say in relation to when she said to let go, how quickly he let go, but there is a conflict in the testimony there. I think it's important to note that the trial judge also said, as he pointed out, I believe Ms. Webb's testimony is accurate. And he relied on that more than he did the sister. And I think looking at cases like Due, where we're looking at...
But how do we know that he relied on that more? I think what Mr. Jeffrey's point is that just because the judge highlighted one thing doesn't mean that he gave it more credence or credibility or weight.
I'll say the record could have been better on this, but I think it's fair to say we all know it did not go on for a minute. And if it did, there would have been a much different string of events, because a minute is a long time for somebody to be inflicting pain. I think the fact that the judge said that he believed the victim's testimony, he's correct and you're correct that he doesn't say, and not the sister's testimony, because she's a liar. He doesn't say that. But we know that he relied on the victim's testimony of the sequence of events, which doesn't include a span of time. But this kind of goes to my point that we should focus on what the judge found and why, because when we're dealing with guilt or innocence, there's an argument to be made that conviction on one limited set of things is effectively a rejection of or acquittal on another set of facts. And when we're looking at something as serious as conviction, you know, guilt beyond reasonable doubt, I think that's different than the cases like Due, where we're talking about whether or not the court can go outside the court's finding and look at other evidence in the record to try and, try and affirm a decision. In Due, we're looking at a provision of his post-release probation. And some of the other cases cited are references cited to civil cases, where the standards are very different. When we're talking about guilt or innocence and imprisonment, I think we should be more careful. I think the court should take a much narrower approach and try to stick as closely as possible to what the trial court relied on. Could the trial court have been more specific about what it did or didn't rely on? Yes, but it did say what it did rely on. It relied on Ms. Webb's testimony that the force was sufficient. And I think the court mistook the act for the force. And as we discussed, the act, you can sexually assault someone in a non-painful way, but it's also possible to do it in a painful way. Neither's good, but the fact that you chose a painful way doesn't mean that using more force is necessary to accomplish the act. It just means the act is something different and even less gentlemanly. So, unless the court has any questions.
Thank you.
Even if that results in keeping that individual there at that location, I assume you wouldn't be making that argument if he'd used that force to drag her across the room.
Certainly not. That would be very different.
But if he used that force to keep her in that location when she wanted to get away from him for up to a minute.
Even a second. Mm-hmm. If he used that force to keep her in that location for any amount of time, he was using force to overcome her will. But that's not what we see here. That's not what she said. That's not even what the sister said, really. They said, even if you believe the sister, that it went on for a minute, there's no evidence that she tried to resist or get away or stop, except that she smacked his hand, he let go, or she said, let go, and he did. And my time's up.
Thank you. We'll come down and greet counsel.